DW, Living Planet, with Jordan Wilden.
All things bright and beautiful, all creatures great and small, goes the Christian hymn which celebrates the entire natural world. But all of these things are at risk, with plants and creatures around us disappearing, animals becoming extinct, warming temperatures killing crops. The world we grew up in is and will be very different from the world we grow old in. Over the next half hour, we'll be exploring some of the life around us, some that you might not notice otherwise, some that you might not appreciate until it's gone. We're exploring stories of how the trees and beasts help us, and what happens if we don't help them.
One lady had actually left going by milk, and she comes back and finds this leopard in the sitting room. And then people now start coming, and they've never seen a leopard in their life. And so many people had gathered, you know, 200. So we knew that the next thing that would happen, somebody would be injured.
Living alongside wild animals in Kenya's capital, the future of biodiversity, and a creature with miraculous healing properties. All this and more here on Living Planet. Our show begins with a walk through the woods in Canada alongside Ottawa's first and currently only certified forest therapist. According to a 2010 Japanese study, forest bathing lowers cortisol levels, pulse, and blood pressure. In other words, the practice reduces stress. Forest bathing, or Shinrin Yoku, as it's known in Japanese, began in the Asian country about 30 years ago. Practiced in a forest environment, it's about slowing down, engaging the senses, and tuning into what's around you. Now it's increasingly being practiced around the world. Sean Griffiths dove into some of the woods in Canada, a country with an abundance of forests, to explore some of the benefits.
14,000 years ago, when the glaciers started to recede,
dressed in warm, waterproof clothing and hiking boots, I've joined a group of forest bathers on the Crazy Horse Trail in woods on the outskirts of Ottawa.
And whales would have been swimming around us.
Trees of maple, oak, white pine and birch tower above us. A light rain taps away on the leafy canopy above. We're beyond the road, beyond digital devices and iPhones, beyond to-do lists, disturbing news reports, and present-day worries. Forest therapist Andrea Prasmowski is grounding us to this place, to this moment in time, and our place in it.
You know, there were the first peoples and the explorers and then us. That was a quick sprint through history. So what's our story here in this moment, on this morning, together on this land, that is part of that big story in this land?
Andrea explains why this is no ordinary hike.
In a forest therapy walk, our surroundings aren't just scenery and a landscape, a backdrop to our interaction. We're actually visiting with the forest. We're actually engaging in relationship building and noticing our connection and taking time to be present to the forest and the more than human world and the beings who are there.
To do so means tuning into all of our senses. At Andrea's invitation, as it's known in forest therapy, we close our eyes and focus on our breathing.
Perhaps you might feel some relaxing in your muscles as your body settles down a bit more on the earth. Can you feel the air on your skin? Bringing our attention now to our sense of hearing, noticing the farthest sound.
And finally, like a big reveal, we turn to our vision sense.
When you open your eyes, perhaps you might open them like you're a newborn, discovering this gift of sight for the very first time and beholding all around you as if you're seeing it all for the first time.
Looking around, things do seem fresh, like a reboot. If this all sounds like mindfulness, a practice usually associated with yoga or meditation, that's at the heart of forest therapy. Research tells us that mindfulness, aimed at being more present and paying attention to what is around us without judgment, can be calming and work to reduce stress. Andrea invites us to venture deeper into the woods, fully engaging all of our senses. We quietly and slowly weave our way along the trail. There is little talking. Much comes into sharp focus. A small red berry on a tree, water droplets on a branch. We arrive at another clearing where we gather in small, intimate circles. We share what we have noticed in the forest.
There's so many different shades and hues and tones of green.
And the shapes of the leaves with the wind going through them too. Some of them just like are shaky and others are like a fan.
You hear the birds in stereo, you know, near and far. And I passed a tree and I saw the tiniest bit of possibly a feather. And I would have missed that if I was just walking through a forest. It's just, it just leapt out at you, you know. Everything's heightened.
Yeah. We're invited to find a sit spot and spend time with a forest being, to look at it, touch it, perhaps smell it. I spend time with a large, slightly battered-looking white pine, which looked like it had been through a lot. Another person sits by a pond, finding the water calming. Andrea ends our forest time with tea, fittingly made from local white pine needles.
Very nice.
So it's with the tea that we formally end the walk and start. This is our threshold to start to return to.
Oh, it's just calming. That's exactly why I came. Just. I'm gonna get tearful.
It was emotional for you.
I'm fine, actually. These sort of things get to me. But no, my life is in a bit of turmoil right now, so this is just what I needed. Thank you. Sorry.
You didn't expect that?
No! Not at all. Oh! Sorry.
Maybe it was a release.
Maybe. Anyway, it's been wonderful. Just,
was there anything in this experience that stood out for you that you found really helpful?
Just the solitude time. As I said, I like being near water, so finding that little bit of a beaver pond was just what I needed, the solitude. And looking up, looking down, the smells, the decaying wood, the rain, it was just what I needed.
Maureen, a family doctor, thinks her patients could benefit from forest therapy.
Probably the number one thing that I deal with is anxiety and stress and all the ways it manifests itself. You know, people coming with chest pain, but the basis is stress. And I think an activity like this just really helps us practice mindfulness, which we know has been scientifically proven to help with anxiety. And just slowing down and taking time to smell and to look and to really see.
At the Happiness Lab at Carleton University in Ottawa, psychology professor John Zielinski looks at the connection between people's mood and the natural world. He says the research tells us that we feel better when we spend time in nature.
The people who have this sense of nature relatedness, this nature connection, report a lot of positive features of mental health. So emotional well-being, a sense of satisfaction with life, more a sense of meaning and purpose in life.
Studies out of Japan, which have honed in on forest bathing specifically, have produced some impressive results. Studies also point to mental health benefits. Hostility and depression scores go down, while liveliness scores go up. Kathy Sager, a recreation therapist at Ottawa's Royal Mental Health Centre, works with patients, who she describes as clients, suffering from schizophrenia and depression.
Psychosis affects perceptions of reality, and we perceive reality through our five senses.
She already leads her patients through indoor mindfulness sessions as they sit in chairs. But she wondered, how might her patients respond in forest bathing in an outdoor setting? She did her research first.
21 of the 28 studies determined that it was a very effective means of treating the symptoms of depression.
She asked Andrea to lead 8 of her patients in a session here at the Fletcher Wildlife Garden, full of trees, birds, groundhogs, rabbits, and ducks. The results were better than she expected.
And at least 2 of the clients distinctly noted feeling calmer after. Those were their own words. I felt calmer after. And one noted he felt anxious in advance of the forest therapy session. Because it was new, because often getting out comes with all this realm of unknowns. So just the experience of getting out, let alone doing something that you're not familiar with. And one of them also noted they were more aware of their surroundings after.
Would you do it again?
Definitely. Definitely I would do it again. And I think it would be the sort of thing that anytime you're doing a new experience, there's that distraction of, what am I doing? I mean, sure, there's part of you that's mindful, but at times your mind wanders. So having the familiarity of oh, I've done this exercise, and honing into it that much more. And also over time, looking at the benefits that accumulate over time rather than a one-time session.
Shan Griffiths for DW in Ottawa.
Nairobi is the only capital city in the world which has a national park full of wildlife within its city borders. Densely populated residential areas, cattle pastures, and even the airport directly border the park, which is only partially surrounded by electric fences. Because of this, the occasional lion or leopard makes its way into the city, often, unfortunately, with fatal consequences for the animal, thanks to the foolishness of their human neighbours. Linda Stauder has the story from Nairobi. Her report is presented by Eunice Wanjiru.
Two rangers fire repeatedly at a lion. Within a few seconds, the animal collapses, dead. It has at least 6 bullets in its body. In the background, at least 20 men scream and shout. They live directly next to Nairobi National Park, from which the lion had wandered into the city. They were trying to scare him out of the neighborhood and, ultimately, are the ones to blame for his death, says a spokesman from the Kenya Wildlife Service.
The noise that were made by people, it aroused the anger of the lion and it injured one person. Now, as a result of that, our personnel who were on the ground reacted to it, and to stop further injuries, they were able to pull it down.
The lion, who was named Mohawk, was one of the most famous lions in Nairobi National Park. It's been about 2 years since his death, which sparked a wave of anger across Nairobi, even among some of the people in the crowd who sparked the chaotic scenes.
I feel bad because the Kenyan Wildlife Service did not just stun the animal and take it back to the park. Instead, they killed the lion.
It remains unclear to this day why the rangers weren't carrying any stun guns, which would have probably saved Mohawk's life. But the scandal has drawn attention away from the root cause of the ongoing conflict between humans and wildlife in Nairobi, the rapidly growing human population. As people encroach on the habitat of wild animals, the consequences can often be fatal for the big cats who accidentally venture into nearby residential areas, explains Paul Gathitu from the Kenya Wildlife Service.
One lady had actually left word by milk, and she comes back and finds this leopard in the sitting room. And then people now start coming, and they've never seen a leopard in their life, and so many people had gathered, you know, 200. So we knew that the next thing that would happen, somebody would be injured. So we were forced to bring down the leopard.
Nairobi is unique in the sense that it's the only major city in the world which directly borders a national park full of wildlife. Many densely populated residential areas are located right next door, and construction sites for new highways and a modern train line now wind their way through the park, which can cause even further problems for the animals, explains the head of the Kenya Wildlife Service, Kitili Mbathi.
As they're constructing at night, sometimes they hit the fence and break the current in the electric wire. The lions periodically test the fence to see if there's a charge in it. And when there's no charge, sometimes they will jump over.
However, the situation usually only turns dangerous because of people's panicked and often downright foolish behavior. Cars honk their horns furiously on Mombasa Road, one of Nairobi's largest main streets. A few motorists have stopped to take selfies with a lion who is curiously examining the fences and driveways. He appears calm at first, but eventually, the noise distresses him so much that he attacks an unsuspecting passerby.
I turned around and saw the lion. He didn't even give me a second to think. Before I could turn and run, he jumped up and hit me with his paw.
Michael Abdul survived, and so did the lion. But a herd of elephants in the nearby small town of Naivasha were less fortunate. A shrieking crowd riled up the animals so much that some turned aggressive, and the situation quickly became dangerous. Paul Gathitu says making the call to shoot the elephants was one of the hardest things he's ever done as a wildlife ranger.
Oh, it's one of the most painful decisions I've ever had to make. We were forced to bring down 3 elephants because of that melee, and there are 300 people and they're shouting. And so we were forced to bring those down to save those people.
Even more disturbingly, some bystanders decided to use the opportunity to get free meat from the carcasses.
Everybody's gone mad. Somebody's down here trying to cut the meat. Another one is cutting on top with his axe. And that was kind of like a stage-managed thing. You know, they really wanted the elephants to be killed.
Wildlife in Kenya is actually protected by very strict laws. They are typically left alone unless human lives are deemed to be in danger. However, Paul Gathitu hopes that one day the Kenya Wildlife Service will no longer be forced to sacrifice the lives of the park's increasingly rare elephants or lions in order to save people who put themselves in a dangerous situation.
Yes, there might be instances where we may be forced to just stop and just say, look, if you get in there, you're on your own. If you act stupid, even in circumstances where you're being given advice, then you will face the consequences.
That report was filed by Linda Stauder in Nairobi and presented by Eunice Wanjiru. The axolotl is probably one of the planet's most bizarre-looking animals, but they're also something of a miracle. Unlike most living creatures, the axolotl does not heal itself by scarring. Instead, it can heal itself through regeneration, and a group of nuns in the tranquil Mexican town of Pátzcuaro are helping keep this rare species of salamander from going extinct. For over 100 years, they've been breeding a special kind of axolotl called the achoque, found only in this region, and they've used the parts to create a special natural cough medicine. Now, they've teamed up with scientists to save the species and learn more about its remarkable healing properties. Christina Faye Mebus has the story. The report is presented by Inika Mules.
Sister Ophelia Morales still remembers her first axolotl. His name was Corazon, which loosely translates to heart or darling. 18 years ago, the Dominican nun from the small Mexican town of Pátzcuaro took him into her care. He had the same unusual features as all axolotls do. Feathery external gills protruding where his ears should be, short stubby legs with tiny feet, a permanent grin across his face. Every day, Ophelia fed Corazon little worms, cleaned his aquarium, and even prayed for him.
It fills me with joy to know that we have so many animals here, and that they are healthy, and we can help them if they ever fall ill. The animals are very healthy and beautiful.
Because she now takes care of so many, Sister Ophelia no longer names her salamander friends who live in the monastery. An entire room is full of aquariums, and there are even more in the adjoining corridor. Each pool contains around half a dozen axolotls. Sister Maria del Carmen Perez thinks she and Sister Ophelia have bred around 300 of them over the years.
It's important to us to help protect the species which is threatened with extinction. We want to work together to help them.
Not far from the monastery is Lake Pátzcuaro, which was once the natural home of a species of axolotl known as achoques, or the Lake Pátzcuaro salamander. But over the years, it's been severely damaged by overfishing and mass tourism. Now it's almost impossible for axolotls to thrive in their natural habitat. But there's still some hope. The habitat crisis has caught the attention of amphibian researchers from all around the world. In fact, it was a group of experts from the US who taught the sisters how to professionally breed the axolotls in the hope of saving the animals, both in the name of God and in the name of science. Because these strange creatures have a special superpower, which makes them invaluable to the world of science. They exhibit a trait called neoteny, which means they reach maturity without ever going through the process of metamorphosis. In other words, although they grow bigger as they get older, they never really mature, It's kind of like staying a child forever. This is probably one of the reasons behind their greatest trick of all, regeneration. Although the ability to regenerate tails or legs is not considered unusual in the amphibian world, axolotls take it to a whole other level. In addition to limbs, they can rebuild their spine, jaws, nerve tissue, even parts of their brains. Not surprisingly, scientists have spent decades trying to decipher the secret behind this amazing ability. Earlier this year, a team of researchers from Vienna, Heidelberg and Dresden finally decoded the axolotl genome, the largest to ever be sequenced. Molecular biologist Alfredo Cruz, who took part in the study, thinks it could be a game changer for human medicine.
Maybe we could also regenerate an entire organ in humans or completely eliminate a tumor. So in the medium term, we might not only be able to restore limbs, but we could defeat cancer.
It's no wonder then that even the Aztecs treated the axolotl with respect thousands of years ago. In fact, the name itself roughly translates to water dog. Atl means water, and lotl means dog. Or more specifically, the canine-headed dog from the Aztec mythology who was associated with lightning and led the souls of the dead into the underworld. Legend says that, fearful of being killed by the other gods, he transformed into an axolotl and fled into the lake to hide. But if you ask the locals of Pátzcuaro, they often have their own take on the origins of the axolotl. Laurie Guzman originally comes from a small island in the middle of the lake, where the axolotl apparently used to live.
On the island, they say that the axolotl was originally a woman who did not want to marry her boyfriend. To escape him, she fled into the water. It was there that she turned into an axolotl, and there she stayed.
The nuns have also developed a strong respect for the axolotl's healing powers. For the past 100 years, they have brewed a medicinal syrup made from parts of the animal. They say it helps to calm a cough. This was how researchers actually came to know the sisters. And hopefully, this combined knowledge and reverence of the axolotl will help save this very special species from the brink of extinction.
That report presented by Inaka Mules, which was filed by Christina Faye Mavis.
Can't get enough Living Planet? Visit dw.com/livingplanet, where you'll find the most current show and a vast archive of our previous episodes.
This week and for the rest of this month is COP14, the meeting of decision makers over biodiversity, with goals of conserving the variety of life on the planet and ensuring resources are used sustainably. The body will be looking at how we can protect ecosystems from pollution, habitat loss and climate change. DW's environment team leader, Sonia Dean, is in the studio with me. So, Sonia, what's the global state of biodiversity?
Well, it's not good, and many people are talking about an extinction crisis. Some scientists even characterize what's happening now as the sixth mass extinction in the history of the planet. And, of course, the only one that's being caused by a single species, humans, us. Especially if you look at the past 50 years or so, where there's really been this acceleration. What the data indicates is that we're causing animal populations to decline by more than half in that half century. And some types of life is being hit harder than others, like freshwater vertebrates, amphibians like frogs, which have declined more than 80% since 1970. In terms of the number of species, and it's really hard to say since we don't even know all the Earth species, there might be 100 million. And WWF, for example, they estimate we're wiping out 10,000 to 100,000 of these 100 million species every year.
And 100,000 is a huge number. So how exactly are we killing these species off?
Well, let's break it down. So pollution and invasive species, those are big factors. Also, climate change is a growing factor. But beyond that, we're eating away the habitat for species by developing more agricultural lands, by urban areas taking over natural areas. There are extractive activities, so cutting down forests for timber, pulling fish out of the sea in these massive nets on a huge scale. And really, if you break all that down, it's largely our consumption habits that are driving this extinction crisis. Like, for example, we love to eat big, juicy hamburgers, but behind that hamburger is this massive ecological footprint. So the amount of land and water that uses, that's actually being taken away from other species.
And that's what we're doing at the moment to destroy species. But what are we doing to preserve biodiversity?
Yeah, so right now, as you mentioned, the Conference of Parties for the Convention on Biological Diversity, it's meeting in Egypt, and the CBD, as the Convention on Biological Diversity is called, it's one of the main international treaties to conserve biodiversity, and it's been signed by almost every country on Earth. At the summit in 2010, parties agreed to what are called the Aichi targets, which include some pretty specific goals, like conserving 17% of land and 10% of marine areas by 2020. And currently at the meeting in Egypt, parties are discussing a new framework for conservation of biodiversity beyond 2020, since those older targets are set to expire.
It's one thing to discuss the targets, though, but how well are they actually being met?
Yeah, good question. Based on this midterm assessment from 2015, although awareness around the importance of biodiversity seems to be increasing, public awareness, this does not yet seem to have translated into actual policies that reduce those pressures on species. And although there are some success stories, yesterday, for example, the mountain gorilla was declared only endangered instead of critically endangered, overall, biodiversity continues to decline. And that's why this new conservation framework is going to be so important.
And how to look for the future of species on planet Earth?
Well, a lot of experts say we really need to ramp up conservation in order to stem this extinction crisis. So that means not only governments implementing conservation policy, it also means a real societal shift and a change in these consumption patterns, our consumption patterns, that are gobbling up the Earth's resources.
And the experts care, they're trying to make policy, but why should we care, everyday people?
Yeah, well, life on Earth, it's a web. Not only are we a part of it, but we also depend on it. There's this kind of wonky term, ecological services. And what that means is everything nature provides for us for free so that we can survive, like clean air, clean water, healthy soils, which allow us to breathe, to eat and drink. All of that depends on intact ecosystems. And when you start to make species go extinct, imagine those species like building blocks in this house of life. And the concern is that at some point, we've removed too many key blocks and the system, the house, collapses. And look at the example of insects. So insects, ecologically, they're extremely important because they pollinate flowers. Without bees and wasps and even flies, we wouldn't have most of the fruits and vegetables that we enjoy today. So the concern around this worldwide collapse of insect populations, which data points to, it could really have concrete consequences for us. This should be a wake-up call.
DW's environment team leader, Sonia Dean, thank you for joining me.
A parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot.
It's all interconnected, the planet, the life on it, and us. We rely on each other. So what do you think? Let's chat. You can email us at livingplanet@dw.com or tweet us at @DW_environment. That's all from us this week. A huge thanks to Inna Kamules, Ileana Giladucci, Lena Hill, and Gerd Georgi for their help producing this show, and to you for listening. I have been, and still am, Jordan Wildon. Until next time.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? We paved paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone?
we'd pay paradise, put up a parking lot. We'd pay paradise, put up a parking lot. We'd pay paradise, put up a parking lot.